G'day, it's Daniel Harford. Welcome to the Best of the Breakfast Club on RSN 927. It was jam-packed. Check it out.
He's got the hat on. He's ready to go. Whitey, good morning.
Good morning, Daniel. No Fitzroy hoodie today. That's been given a rest. How did you go yesterday? Because yesterday was a very special day. It was Daniel Harford Day. Only five cases in Victoria.
One.
Well, yes, that's right. Daniel Harford Day 2.0. How did you get through the day? Because you got a lot of love, a lot of people just checking in, celebrating with you. It was a big day.
It was a big day. We like when it gets down to Daniel Harford Day sort of numbers. That's what we like. Daniel Harford Hawthorne 2.0, as you say. We're really keen to get to Daniel Harford Carlton and see what happens from there.
Yes.
That's where we're really keen to get into. And then, Adam, and then we get to Robert Parrish Day, and that's where we get super excited for mankind. And when we get to zero, that's what we're really keen to see. So we had a bit of fun yesterday. You got to keep yourself entertained through these periods, Whitey. That's my theory. I've got to make myself laugh at times, and dad gags are the only thing I've got. So that's seemingly the model for me going forward, to just keep myself entertained these days, because not much else to do.
No, well, I said it's almost, for me, it's almost like Fitzroy bingo of all my favourite Fitzroy players through the 80s and 90s. And pretty much now, outside of Paul Roos, which is number one, and Gary Pert, number three, they've all been ticked off. So yesterday, Bernie Quinlan, it was a big day for Fitzroy fans.
What a player.
And there's been Alistair Lynch, but two of my sort of unique favourites were Matthew Armstrong, who wore 14 at Fitzroy, and Darren Kappler, who wore 21 at Fitzroy. I don't know why I like Darren Kappler so much, but I did.
He was 21. Well, see, he played with me at the Hawks. We were teammates.
Yeah, he went. I think he was 11 at Hawthorn.
He was. My word.
So I sort of ticked off quite a few of my favourite players through the Fitzroy days. But geez, wouldn't Paul Roos be good at some point soon?
Yeah, a little bit of Paul Roos action is nice. After Daniel Harford, that's fine. So when you talk about the greats of all time, Carlton, number two, I mean, there's a clear standout. There's me, and then there's a couple of others. Dominic Fodier and John Nicholls might sneak in there, if you like. Peter Motley, perhaps, for a little while. But there's really only one that stands out, Brett Backworth.
Brett who?
Backwell. Brett Backwell. He was number two as well. Yeah. We have a bit of fun. Corey McKernan, best and fairest winner in the number two. So we're keen to see that happen sooner rather than later. Have a bit of fun yesterday. A little bit of fun. Another winner for the early mail, Whitey.
Yes, I know. That's 3 in 4 days, I think.
3 in 4 days, yes.
I think it is. I had a very interesting day yesterday because for the first time, and this is, I know I exaggerate, but this isn't exaggerating. For the first time in nearly 3 months, I wore jeans. For the first time in around 3 months, I wore a shirt. And for the first time in 3 months, I drove a car over a kilometre and a half. And I got a bit nervous.
Where'd you go? And
Obviously, I had no idea where my wallet was because I haven't used my wallet in 6 weeks.
That's a surprise.
I didn't know where my keys were.
Well, there's a surprise.
I had no idea. Yeah, I know. But this is like no idea where my keys were. And I wasn't even sure. The only reason I knew my car would start was because Emma had been driving it at times. But when I drove in and I had the permit and all that sort of stuff, I had no idea what to expect driving into the city. And I drove in at about 10:30 in the morning, or 10 o'clock in the morning. I kind of thought that there might have been a strong police presence and that you'd be sort of blocked off areas where people were getting checked and all this sort of stuff. But I must confess, driving in, it felt like just normal.
Yeah, no, it's not really different. Not that I've been doing too much driving.
Daniel, I haven't left my house in 3 months. I've just been in tracksuit pants and shorts or Fitzroy hoodies or whatever, for a long period of time.
It's not what I'm hearing. I'm hearing you are a familiar and well-known figure on the main Yarra Trail. That's what I keep hearing from all my sources.
Yes, yes.
That you're outside going bananas with your legs as opposed to the vehicle.
Yes, that's correct. So, but it was honestly quite weird because it had been such a long time. And you know what made me really disappointed? I got into work Now, I've been communicating with my work colleagues, but I haven't been seeing my work colleagues. Yes. I sort of walked in with a little bit of confidence. I've lost quite a few kilos. I thought there's going to be a lot of comments around, oh, gee, you're looking fantastic. Yeah, have you lost some weight? Or, you know, I really was expecting the comments. I didn't get one.
Nothing.
Not one.
That's a very disappointing outcome. Very disappointing outcome. Worked way too hard for no comments.
Correct. I wanted comments. So to the baker, did the shirt fit? The shirt fitted very well. It was, I'd describe the shirt as swimming on me.
Oh.
But no comments.
Update yesterday. There was no mid-morning update on the situation at your house, which I was surprised at. I thought there might have been an update.
Well, I forgot. But I must confess, there was a bit of plateauing going on.
Oh, plateau. Okay. Still swimming, though. Still swimming shirts. That's good.
It's a tough situation when you don't eat for 2 days of seven and you get a plateau situation. three or four weeks of really strong activity and then, nothing.
Wasn't to be.
It was a little bit, but not as much as I would have liked. But anyway.
All right. Well, maybe
people out there, do the 5-2 diet. It works. It works. It absolutely works.
Yeah. We'll see.
It does.
It does. I've seen it in you. You're the poster boy for the 5-2.
Well, that's exactly right.
We've got shirt swimming going on. You've got shirt swimming. How do you reckon it's going to go for Brad Cratch? How do you reckon his shirt swimming at the moment? Do you think Brad's made of blue? And Tyson Stengel? When you're on the market?
You know what?
An illicit substance.
You know what? That was a setback for Brad. however, I don't think it will make any difference at all.
Right.
In what he's worth, what Adelaide will get in return for him if he was to leave, what Brad's going to get in his pay packet, what club he goes to, I don't think it'll make any difference at all. What do you think?
Oh, no, it might just be uncomfortable. No, it probably won't make a difference, but it'll be uncomfortable for a little bit, I think. If you're going to a new club, right, if you've got a new opportunity elsewhere, and that's the last sort of memory that they have for you, or that's the overwhelming last story that comes with you, I think that's a bit uncomfortable, isn't it, when you're going somewhere else. If you're familiar with people and they know you a bit better, you can say, well, you know, this, and you'd be able to move forward pretty strongly, pretty quickly. But I think if they're going somewhere else, a new market, so to speak, I think it does create unnecessary anxiety. How about that? Unnecessary anxiety. I don't think it would affect his future, to your point, but it does create unnecessary anxiety, I reckon, which is less than ideal.
Look, it's not ideal, and he's going to have to go through, particularly him, not so much Tyson Stengel, but, you know, being the high profile of person of the two, he's going to have to go through a pretty sort of embarrassing... He's going to be heavily focused over the next period of time, and whatever he chooses to do, whether that is stay at Adelaide or go to another club, he's going to have to answer those questions. But I think in general terms, moving forward, I don't see it making a difference at all. I mean, there were reports yesterday suggesting that it's going to cost him hundreds of thousands of dollars over a new contract, and maybe clubs were now hesitating going after him. I don't see that being the case at all. And I'm not sort of casting aspersions here or anything like that, but I don't think it sort of shocks people anymore when people get caught with illicit substances and all that sort of thing. It's just part of society now, and the AFL are part of society. I just think it happens. We're not in the Dale Lewis world anymore, where when Dale Lewis made the comments, everyone sort of went, oh, that can't be right. That's ridiculous. What a stupid thing to say.
Yeah.
It's not a problem in AFL. AFL mirrors society, and often with the players that play AFL football and get the money that they get, not only does it mirror society, it actually magnifies society because of a lot of the money that they have. And these guys are young men, and this is what happens. It just does.
Tell you what happens when you finish tied for third in the Irish Open. You jump 65 spots in the world golf rankings. That's what happens to you, Adam White. You go from 297 to 232, and you make a little bit of cash on the side as well. It's good business. And Maverick Antcliffe, Aussie golfer, did that on the weekend, and we've been able to track him down, which we're very pleased about.
This is Mav, very good.
Welcome.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Going all right, buddy. How are you doing in the wash-up after a tie for third there at the Irish Open?
Yeah, not that I'm too bad at all, really.
Well, you sound like you're going beautifully because I know there's been some limited opportunities to be playing golf this year with what's going on in the world, and you find yourself in the Irish Open, and impressively, Maverick, you put yourself in contention, and you go really deep into the tournament, looking like you're probably going to win it. Outside of the winner who shot 6-under when it clearly wasn't easy to score on Sunday, you stood up and announced yourself to the world. Is that how you see it?
I haven't really thought about it like that. I mean, I was just really happy to just put four solid rounds together and obviously be in the final group on Saturday and, just play solid on Saturday and then, play solid again on Sunday, to be honest.
Yeah, so going into it, were you considering yourself a live chance to go pretty deep? I mean, you've won on the China Tour for the last couple of years and done some really cool things there, but this is probably next level again, I imagine, on the European Tour.
Yeah, I mean, I played pretty well in Portugal last week and, I've just been playing pretty nice last couple of weeks and, I just kind of try to approach it as any other week and the way it was shaping out, it kind of looked like the draw might have been against me a little bit, but obviously in Ireland, like the weather changes pretty quickly and, just kind of got off to a nice start, finished off Friday's round on Saturday morning, finished quite strong, and then that put me in a good position, and then I had to hang around a few hours and then start on the Saturday afternoon for the third round. So, just had a bit of momentum on my side and, just tried to capitalise on it, really.
It's awesome that we're speaking to you, Maverick. I was up way too late watching you play the other night at the Irish Open. Tell us a little bit about the golf course, because it seemed a really pretty golf course, and it was quite cold as well. I mean, I know that there was a delay for frost going into the final round. Take us through what the conditions were like.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the course was, the track was sick. Kind of like just like a parkland course just north of Belfast. Rough was really thick, but it was, it was good. It was pretty breezy, and it was off the north, so, the mornings were really cold. I think there was a frost delay on the Friday morning and on Sunday morning. And Sunday morning there was a frost delay to start and then there was followed up by fog rolled in. So the tee times ended up getting pushed back an hour, which was, it was kind of not nerve-wracking, but I was kind of chomping at the bit to get out there on Sunday arvo. So having to sit around for an extra hour was a bit of a pain, to be honest.
Absolutely. So talk us through your sort of journey through to this point, because the great thing about professional golf is you can go so many different ways. There's so many different sort of, it's almost like a choose your own adventure book. You can go all sorts of different ways to get to where you want to get to. Last year, winning three times in China is quite a remarkable achievement in itself, to then find yourself on the European Tour. Why did you go that way to sort of navigate your way through to where you are now?
It actually kind of like goes back to like 2017. I went to Q school in Oz once I moved back from the States in 2016 when I went to college and missed my card in Australia by a shot. And I kind of, like in Australia, like if you don't have a card, you can't really play the big ones and then you just have like a lot of pro-am stuff. And I really wanted to just play like four round tournament golf. So I actually went to Q school in China in 2017 and I played really well. I finished fifth on the order of merit that year. And then that actually got me like my foot in the door to play on the Asian tour. So I did that in 2018 and played in Australia in 2018. And then for some reason, like events kept getting like changed and stuff on Asian tour early last year. And I still had status in China. So I didn't have anything on my calendar, so I just went up there and played the first two. Like, my intent was to, because I played well in Bangladesh, so that would have got me a few Asian tour starts with the re-rank. My goal was just to play Australia in Asia. And then I got to China, I win the first two events, and then obviously my scheduling changed a lot. Obviously, I knew what was up for grabs, so I just prioritised that for the rest of the year. And then, yeah, November rolled around, I had a European tour card.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing. And it's not just the fact that you won three times. There were seven top fives and nine top tens. Does that sort of help you then when you go to the next level again? Because one thing that was really noticeable both in Portugal and again in Ireland is you didn't seem overawed by the occasion. You see often golfers that can't handle being near the top of the leaderboard, but you remained, at least on the outside, very composed. Does it help that you've been in those positions so many times recently, understanding the moment?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of one of those things, though. Like, I mean, you know, obviously, when you're a little kid, like, you want to play in the final group, like, you know, whether it's on the US tour or European tour, and, you know, you've got the cameras and stuff like that. So, obviously, it was pretty surreal. But, yeah, obviously, like, you can't substitute experience. And being in those positions and kind of just realizing that you don't really need to do much different because you got there, obviously, you know, doing things well in the first place. Like, you don't need to go out there and chase or do anything. Just kind of try and build momentum and just be there with, like, you know, if it's nine or six holes to go, just give yourself a chance to just back yourself, really. So, yeah, well, I mean, those experiences definitely helped a lot.
I reckon Craig Gabriel, because they're big in the UK, these two, and I know that Craig Gabriel is bigger than anyone in the UK at the moment. Has been for a long time now. He's covering the French Open for us on RSN Breakfast, and we're very appreciative of that. Craig, good morning.
Gentlemen, good morning.
Can you tell me, because I'm sure they're in the Rolodex, how old Matthew and Luke Goss are today, please?
Well, you know what? The thing is with them... we had a bit of a fallout.
Oh.
So I took them out of the Rolodex. We don't exchange cards or anything like that. So,
what happened?
Yeah, they didn't get my permission when they wrote that song about being famous.
Boy. Well, that's disappointing feedback because what you've become known as around here is a friend of the stars.
Not just in sport.
Not just in sport.
Real stars, not them.
So do you know how old they are?
Pardon?
Do you know how old they are?
No, as I said, I wiped them clean. I didn't look at anything to do with them, so...
Right. Well, if you were mates again, you could wish them a happy 52nd birthday today. Right. So you're outside the window, Whitey.
52nd.
Not going to happen.
52 today for the Goss Boys from Bross.
The problem is they look way more than 52.
Oh, now this is that's why you fall out because you keep abusing them, Craig. That's why you keep abusing them. Now tell us what's happened at Roland Garros overnight. Rafa got through, did he?
Rafa did get through and relatively well, 6-4, 6-4, 6-2 against Igor Gerasimov of Belarus, and he's still figuring that the conditions are not good for him because they're too heavy and stuff like that. But anyway, he's through. Dominic Thiem got through, also in straight sets. Serena Williams had a slow start. She was trailing for almost the entire first set and then ended up winning the first set on a tie break. And after that, just raced through the match, 6-love in the second. So those were some of those center court matches, Philippe Chatrier matches. But there is a potential major upset that could be unfolding on court Suzanne Longlan, which is the second biggest court. The number four seed, Daniil Medvedev, is playing Marton Fukovic of Hungary, and you've got to be careful how you say his name. The Hungarian has won the first two sets 6-4, 7-6, and Medvedev is up a break in the third at 2-1, but he's not a happy camper. One racket is never going to be used again, and it'll be perfect for hitting around the net post. But that's what's happening right now. And John Newman is still on court. He's lost the first set 6-3 to Pablo Carreño Busta, the Spaniard who reached the semifinals of the U.S. Open a couple of weeks ago. He's the 17th seed here. These conditions are perfect for Carreño Busta. It hasn't been a good day for the Australians. Two have finished both lost James Duckworth as well as Alexander Vukic, who came through the qualifying rounds. And I spoke to Vukic afterwards, and it's the first time he's been in the main draw of one of the majors, and he picks up €60,000. He came through the qualifying, and he said that's going to come in very handy because that'll go back into his tennis rather than investing or anything like that. But he feels he quite likes it from this sort of an environment and this sort of level of tournament.
Well, that's good news for the young Aussie with a little bit of cash in the pocket. Jordan Thompson, he went down as well in straight sets, did he?
Yeah, that was yesterday. Yesterday was absolutely miserable after six, the first day of the tournament. The six Australians that played, only two advanced, and both of them were the women players, Astra Sharma and Daria Gavrilova. They won't be playing again tomorrow, but they'll play the day after. I mean, the French Open, rather, plays first rounds across 3 days. So, you know, that was not a good start yesterday. And as I said, it's not proving too good today. With two out of the three gone and the third one in trouble.
It's been really interesting, Craig, just listening to a lot of the commentary around the conditions because it clearly, and yeah. You talked about this yesterday, it's clearly so different to what we're used to with the French Open. But, you know, you're seeing players wearing tracksuit pants and long sleeve tops. It looks like sort of, you know, night social tennis on a Tuesday night in the middle of winter. But it is very different, and you know some of the players are not coping with it.
They're not happy with it. They really aren't. You know, I thought Vika Azarenka's line yesterday was priceless. She said, "This is too cold. I live in Florida. This is too cold." They haven't been very happy with the conditions, but I think they should be damn well grateful in the fact that they're being able to play a major, and that the French Federation have pulled all sorts of strings and done whatever they have been able to do to put this event together and have it be played. You know, a couple of the players have made that comment in between saying the conditions are awful. So, they've been complaining about the balls, which are Wilson balls rather than Babolat balls, which have always been used. And they said it's making it even heavier and slower.
One of the comments Alf, was that they wouldn't give those balls to a dog.
Yeah, that was from Dan Evans. I mean, Dan Evans should just be grateful he's playing.
Yeah, Dan, sit down and shut up, mate.
Yes, exactly right. He's only the 32nd seed. He hasn't got the authority to be babbling after what he's been through in his personal life that kept him off the tour for about a year because of a banning. So just get on and play. You know what I mean?
Kane Nishikori took him out, didn't he?
Yes, and nicely too. And Kay has hardly played. Kay has played very, very little tennis in the last 12 months, so that was a big effort.
Probably looks like a Marbiel Chol, and we've got Josh Caddy that's available to play in that role as well. He trained well and strongly again today, so we've got an ideal look that it may be.
All right, so that's Damien Hardwick talking about some replacements, possible replacements for Tom Lynch, who Richmond announced yesterday would be missing the first final against Brisbane. They're very early to do it. On the front foot, early doors, Rocket E, welcome to you.
Morning, Daniel. How are you, mate?
Going very well. Thank you. Nice to have you with us again on a beautiful Melbourne morning. That's something we don't see too often. Or in finals, does it happen a bit more, Rocket, where we rule out our stars a bit earlier than normal?
No, I just think about that myself, that normally as a coach you keep that to the last minute. You make a last-minute change. You'll name them. Which is always a psychology ploy more than anything. I wonder whether they think, oh, we'll name that early, so therefore if there's any little doubt about Andrews, well, he won't play either, so they'll actually not get him to play.
Flush him out.
Yeah, so therefore whether it's that's their ploy, I would have thought. To try and hopefully Brisbane don't play Andrews, so therefore it evens it up. Rather than if they'd named Lynch, therefore they would have named Andrews. I don't know, but it's not very usual that teams do that.
That's a very good way. I think this is why he's the best in the business, Whitey, because I would never have thought of trying to flux the opposition selection out with your news.
Well, see, I want to take that a little bit further, Rocket, when that sort of thing happens, so say you're in the Brisbane camp, does it make any difference at all? I mean, obviously he's one of their really good players, but when a player is missing, I mean, are they doing cartwheels in the meeting room planning this match, or with the way Richmond plays, it only makes a minimal difference?
Oh, I think it's somewhere in between. I think it would make a bit more than a minimal difference from Brisbane's point of view, because of the what Lynch can do. Like, he can have bad games, but he can kick two or three quickly in 10, 15 minutes to swing the momentum. Also having that height factor. Say Andrews doesn't play. They don't... Chole may be there, but he may kick one or two. But he's not going to have the ability to kick five or six. So I think that is just Riewoldt, and they can put all their attention to Riewoldt. So I don't think any of the... Both teams are either one-man teams, but by the same token, I think Brisbane would be more pleased that he's not playing rather than playing.
Because it made me think about this with the news coming out yesterday. Who is Richmond's most important player? Who is the one player, and this is to both of you, who is the one player that, not so much they can ill afford to lose, but the one that they would not want to lose the most?
Yeah, it's a good question. I suppose history has shown that Martin doesn't play, they tend to struggle a bit because he can turn games. So if you put him to one side, because that's an obvious one.
I'm Nick Foster.
Yeah, I was going to say Grimes or Loston would be the one, I reckon. Mm. I reckon Grimes probably, because he can play on both talls and smalls. Just especially with Asprey out, and I know Bolter's done very well, but I think it just maybe unbalances their defence a little bit.
It's an interesting question too, because we've seen throughout the season, haven't we, that they've been without a lot of their really important players and stars, and they've still been able to do what they've done. Presty has been one of their biggest and best big game players for a couple of years. Shane Edwards, I thought, was one of their real critical players up in the last 12 months or so, 18 months or so, and hasn't been there, and they've still been able to do it. So it's sort of hard to pinpoint. Dusty's obviously the obvious one, as Rocket says, and life's difficult without Dusty because he's such an extravagant athlete. He's amazing. But I would least like to lose, if I was Damien Hardwick, I'd least like to lose Nick Foster. Not that they say it's going to affect our performance and we're going to lose, but I think he's really one of the pillars that they build their game around.
Mm. No, it'll be interesting.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting for the whole final series. Teams, and we mentioned last week about the injuries and how much they're going to impact. And I think it'll impact more this year than any other year. So, and with the compressed season and that, there'll be some players, well, obviously there will be, but probably more than other years, carrying little niggles or fatigue at certain parts of their legs and sort of things. So whether the soft tissues open up, so especially now the increased speed of the game. So it'll be interesting to see how teams cope with it.
So while we're on that game, Rocket, and we've built up to that one this Friday night at the Gabba, we've talked about the Brisbane Lions in the last week or so and whether or not they're better placed having been through what they went through last season. Obviously a straight set exit from the Lions. They emerged from nowhere last year and they finished top four, and all of a sudden they were out in straight sets. What do they learn from that? Are they better placed because of that experience, do you think?
I think the way they've performed this year, yes, they are better placed. I think they've handled that really well because they've had a far better season, so I think they're more mature. Their biggest issue for the last 2 years, aside their last two games in the finals, was kicking straight. Yeah. That hasn't been rectified. So that cost them last year against Richmond, even though Richmond looked a better side, the scoring shots weren't much different. So they've got to do it. But I think they've matured. I don't think it'll be a weight for them to carry. I think playing at home is going to be an advantage. Richmond are a different side with some injuries and players out. So it'll give them a really good chance and a really good side to be able to win the game. So if Lynch, obviously not playing, if Andrews does play, I think it swings a little bit their way. But I'm still favouring Richmond. But I think what could happen on that question, Half, is if they lose it, does that then become a millstone?
Yeah.
That they've the media and jump on and say, well, they lost two last year, they lost this one, They've got to win a final. If they don't win a final, it's two wasted years, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that could become a bit more pressure if they lose this week.
So how do you play that this week if you're Chris Fagan, knowing that that might and probably will come if they do lose? And let's be honest, it wouldn't be an embarrassment to lose to a generational team like the Tigers, but they want to win it. How do you play that if you're Chris Fagan this week leading up into this game? Do you mention that sort of stuff?
Well, I don't think
last year?
No, I don't think you mentioned it at all. No, I think you're more on this... on the situation where we're a better side, we've proved we've won more games, we finished second on the ladder for a reason, etc., etc. So it's more about the way we play. Look at Richmond, I think they've lost so many games to Richmond now that they need to address that, as in their preparation, their homework they do. They can't just say, oh, we'll just play our way, because that's not going to totally work against Richmond. You need to know what they do, how they move the ball, where we need to put pressure on, how we stop Riewoldt, what Martin does, when we get the ball, to give ourselves a chance of scoring, do we use the corridor a little bit more, do we still use the boundary, whatever they need to have a plan to go in to be able to beat Richmond.
We were talking about this yesterday, Rocket, about who is the number one seed going into the final series. Now, the obvious thing to say is Port Adelaide, because they finished the home and away season on top, but obviously it doesn't necessarily mean that. Going into the series, is it Port Adelaide the team to beat, or do you think it's Richmond, Brisbane, because they've got the home final advantage the whole way through? Who would you be looking at as the team to beat?
I think it's Richmond. I think Richmond are the one. I think there's still a little question mark on the others. The only question mark I've got on Richmond is the fitness of Dodge. No, having Lynch out, and then there's Bolt and Prestia come back. How fit is Prestia? Well, like, we know he's a good player, but there's still just that little... That's the only doubt I've got on them, and it's very minor. So Richmond, for me, are the team to beat. They win this week, a week off. I think they'll be cherry ripe, so... I think they're the team to beat. I think the Port Geelong game will be an interesting one about where they're at, both teams, because there's a bit of question mark on both sides.
Mm. So we spoke to Luke Beveridge yesterday, and we talked about sort of themes through the year and how you get your players up, and do you start treating them differently once you get to a final series compared to a home and away season in what you say and how you train them. What's your view going into a final series? Do you try and keep it as normal as possible? Do you have to funk it up a little bit to try and get a response from the players, or is that just naturally going to happen because you are in a final series?
I think it's naturally going to happen. I think you just got to read the group. I mean, some groups might be more anxious, so you just really got to bring it down. Might be more pressure because of history, whether it's say in Brisbane's case. I think you just got to read the group. If it's an experienced campaign, say in Richmond, they'll probably just get themselves up. If you read a group that they are, for whatever reason, a bit flat, well, you might need to razz it a little bit, I suppose, or a theme up. But depends on your own coaching. If you have themes during the year, like I hear that Luke's got themes, he'll probably build up to a theme that he's had and probably just keep that the same, so they buy into that. So it really depends on your group and what you believe in. I wouldn't think that any of the teams would be really now to have the bells and whistles and try and motivate them externally, I suppose, if it's the right phrase. Because I think they're right for a final series. They know where they're at. I think they'd be excited about going to the final series. Probably Collingwood's place, probably looking forward to the end of the season with all the trouble they have.
Yeah, well, that's true. What about the final series? I mean, there's conversations in the last couple of days about the pre-finals by Rocket, which was brought in a couple of years ago because your type, you coach people, decided to rest 15 players in the last round when things were secure and nothing could be affected. And the game didn't like that look. Rocket, it questioned the integrity of the competition to a degree, and Melbourne Storm went through a similar conversation across the weekend as well with Craig Bellamy dropping 12 players, or managing 12 players from his lineup because nothing could change. And now it seems to be the motion is about having a week off so we can get the players best prepared for the finals campaign. We've got the best players out there at the biggest time of year. Does it matter why we have it, the bye, and is it a good thing in your eye?
Yeah, it's a good question. You hear a lot of arguments both ways. I'm not strong on either way, to be honest. I can understand getting players fresh and you get your best players available. Some people have recommended have the bye before the grand final. Don't have a bye until, so you've got your two best teams have got a week off.
That's what the NFL does.
Yeah, so that's not a bad idea. The integrity of the competition argument with, I think it was North Melbourne, wasn't it, a few years ago?
Maybe Freo
as well.
Yeah.
And I think that's just an anomaly of the competition, just where they bring a rule in. You can't make more than six changes unless you make a application and justification for it. So I'm not here nor there. I think a lot of people missed the footy on the weekend. Would have liked to have had it. Yeah, six and one half a dozen the other for me. I think teams, I can see the merit of getting players fit. So teams like West Coast and Richmond would be advantageous with it. We'd like that. If we didn't have the week bye, I don't know how Collingwood could get to Perth. I suppose that game would be played in Queensland then. It'd change the game around.
Yeah, things possibly change, does it? Because that's the other part of the conversation, Rocket, is that you work all year, all season long, however that long that season is, 17 or 22 games, and you give yourself a position to be a top four team and earn that double chance, and maybe that's dissipated because of that, the fact that you have to rest a week. You lose momentum, the other team gets a chance to get a healthier list, and it takes away any sort of advantage that you seemingly might have coming into a finals campaign.
Yeah, and that's a fair point as well. I suppose the first year they had it, the Dogs highlighted that by them minimising the advantage of a top four side. But 17, 18, 19 have all been top four teams have won it. Back to normality. That's a fair point too. It does dilute the advantage of a top four side. But if you're good enough, you'll win it anyway. So I don't know if it's a compelling argument either way. I think there is some points either way. Do they count each other out? I'm not really strong either way.
So whether it's West Coast with the players that they've got coming back from injury that might be a little bit underdone, Dion Prestia at Richmond's another example of someone that looks like he's going to come in for a final series having not played pretty much all year. Did you ever go through examples of that into a final series where it's really playing on your mind whether you play someone because it's a final and the risk attached to that? And if you had your time again, would have you done things differently? Were you more like someone that would err on the side of caution in that scenario?
I think a quality player, I think you play. The one that sticks out for me was, he was only young, was Sean Higgins. Played the final against, must be the first final against Geelong, 2008. I think, the preliminary final against Geelong 2008. And Sean had smashed his ankle 12 weeks earlier or something and trained really well, and we knew a quality player. And it was just a toss-up, but we decided to go with him, and he did quite well. He did quite well. You just got to monitor whether his fitness levels as far as seeing the game out, that individual. But generally, I think if you've got a few coming back, that becomes an issue. But if you've just got one, and you see how they train, you know the individual, I think it's a case by case. Obviously, they've got a lot of confidence in Prestia. He's mentally tough. He'll be able to probably, he'll run out of gas a little bit, so they'll probably interchange him a little bit more. But Bolton's coming back. He's missed a few weeks. Caddy's only been back for one game. They had a bye. So there's a few there that are a little bit underdone match fitness, but it's just how they monitor them. If they get an injury, a player goes off or a concussion, that adds another layer to it, doesn't it? That puts the load then on those players. So that's the risk you take.
A bit happening there. And the West Coast Collingwood one, Rocket, we found out yesterday, Mark McGowan, the Premier of WA, decided that because Collingwood are only having a 7-day quarantine, they are considered a dirty team in terms of biosecurity protocols. And if West Coast lose, they'll have to quarantine for 14 days in their own state. Not allowed to do anything inside their house for 14 days because Collingwood are dirty. It's Adam Simpson said on the back of that, it's a good incentive to win.
It is a good incentive to win. It's a strange one. Well, if he thought they were a dirty side, why would he let them in the state and not get them to quarantine for 14 days, which means they'd have to play in Queensland? But if he thinks they are a dirty side or an unclean side, why let them in? It doesn't make sense. It seems maybe a bit of intention seeking, I think, but which is a bit of a... bit of a shame, but it's a bit. It is a bit of an incentive for West Coast, but they might be able to have Mad Monday. They have a mad fortnight away, won't they? You know, but don't want to rest at home for 2 weeks. So yeah, it's strange, very very odd.
They'll be hoping that Mad Monday's not for another couple of weeks. The West Coast Eagles, if they can get through the first one. You talk about injuries and managing them and getting them right after that week. I mean, it does give them a chance, probably more than any other team, to get a few players back that weekend off last weekend, Rocket, because they've had such trouble in the back end of the season with their list.
Yes, they've had a lot of players out. Obviously, Yeo's out for the season. I heard yesterday that. I don't know what the Simpsons said, but a West Coast correspondent said they'll all be right. And I can't believe McGovern. Anyway, there'd be, you know, it's got to be a query on McGovern. Kennedy went off that ankle. That was 2 weeks ago. But then there's Sheed, isn't there? Did he play?
Shuey.
Yeah, so they're going to have a few, aren't they, that question mark on. So... That's their dilemma. So if McGovern didn't play and Kennedy didn't play, it really throws it back to take that disadvantage of Collingwood of being in quarantine for 7 days, takes that, actually dilutes that a bit and swings it back in a bit Collingwood's favour.
I'm going to be really interested in how that game plays out, because there are going to be West Coast Eagles players that are underdone, so they won't want the game necessarily played quickly. They want to be able to get in front and control the game, take the pace out of it and look after their players. Collingwood's got a real opportunity. And look, they have struggled all year to score, except for potentially round one against the Dogs. But if they can get off to a fast start and make West Coast play quick, it really, I think, advantages the Magpies significantly with these players that are going to be underdone. They'll want to be managing them through games, slow ball, all that sort of stuff. Collingwood need to start well, and if they do, they're right in this game.
No doubt, and they have been up until the last month. They've been an excellent first quarter team. Collingwood have scored on an extraordinary percentage of their goals in the first quarter. Like it's 40% or to 50% of their goals they get in the game as the first quarter. Some, even when they kick 5 goals out of 8 some games, like in the first quarter, they start really well. So they can get off the fly, and they're capable of doing that. West Coast then have got to chase, as you say, so do their energy levels. The only thing with West Coast, if they do get in front, Adam, and we've spoken about this a fair bit, they love to play the chip catch game, take time off clock, and they don't do it really well against good sides. It lets the others back in the game. So if they do that, I reckon that'll suit Collingwood as well. Collingwood will get the ball back off them. So, yeah. But I think they believe in themselves in that area of the game. I don't think they think they're bad at that. But they don't score when they do that. They won't score against Collingwood if they do that. They won't score. So that will give Collingwood an opportunity.
Well, I think we've said this a few times this year, which just sort of goes against my argument in a point, but the Eagles' best football's been played when they have got behind and they have had to actually start to play up tempo. And, Geelong's the classic example. I still think probably the best game, or certainly the top three best games of the year, where Geelong got out in front and the Eagles had to play fast football to get over the top of them. And that was a really high-quality match. But I just think in this situation with the players the Eagles have got out or have had out, they'd want to be controlling the tempo of the match to look after their players. So you can't do that if you're behind on the scoreboard.
No, for sure. There's probably some... But you've got to be mindful. You don't tell the players that, because it'll seek in subconsciously. The fact we'll get fatigued. I think they've got to attack the gap. They just can't afford to let Collingwood be 3 goals up a quarter time. So if it's a nil or draw at quarter time, West Coast will be okay. But if they do... the other way, they've got to chase the whole game then, and the fatigue levels can kick in.
Now, Saturday mornings for my entire life, I basically, have had involvement with the Could Have Been Champions, an iconic group of men who have done a great job entertaining us for 40 years, if you don't mind, and they're celebrating that anniversary this year with a new book that's out as well. Ian Cover has been there front and centre, watching it all unfold and contributing to the madness along the way, and he joins us on The Breakfast Club. Cove, good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Half, and hello to Whitey as well, somewhere there in the ether.
Yeah, he's in the ether. 40 years, Cove, of the Could Have Been. So, these things I know sort of sneak up on you, but when I'm sure you've had a chance to reflect on how it's all unfolded and got to this point. Can you believe the journey you've been on with this group of mates?
Absolutely not. And it's funny, you know, along the way we haven't really sat down much and analysed it or reflected on it. And it's only in sitting down to do the book to mark the 40th season that you do start to think about the journey. And sometimes, you know, people say, oh, it's a long time, 40 years. And then on other occasions, it just feels like one big long year. and it's still going. And while you're talking milestone, it was 33 years ago this week, in fact, yesterday, that I first set foot in the studio and behind the microphone at the old 3UZ, doing breakfast with John Blackman. There you go.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
Yesterday?
Yeah, 33 years ago. In fact, the Could Have Beens appeared at the halftime of the 1987 Grand Final. And then I had to, you know, there's quite a milestone in our careers we've been at on the MCG. You know, we're only in our seventh season at that stage, and we've done the halftime entertainment. And then I had to go to bed early then the next day because I had to be up to go to radio, breakfast radio on the Monday morning.
Magnificent. Hey, Cove, where did it all start? How did it come together, this group of sports lovers?
Yeah, well, look, it started with Jeff Richardson and Simon Whelan. They were uni mates. They were in a band which was called the Man-Sized Saladas. Which I think that was the name and the band sort of sum it all up, really, and where they went. But they used to go to the footy together, and they just had this idea about doing a program which, you know, gave voice to the fans, and they put the idea to management at Triple R, and they got a spot, and then it all grew from there. And I didn't know them, but a mate who was involved got on to me because I was writing the football in the Geelong Advertiser at the time, and I came on the phone as the provincial spy. and I spoke to them all year on the line. I've not even met them. I thought, grand final day, I might go up to Melbourne and meet them. So I went up to the Triple R studios. And at 9:10 on a Saturday morning, I was greeted by a bloke wearing overalls and holding a long neck of Melbourne bitter. And he said, "G'day." He said, "I'm Ron Main. I do the VFAs." And I said, "Of course you do."
Hey, Covey, over the years, what's the one thing that you're most proud of what you've been able to achieve with the Could Have Been Champions? They said 40 years. What's the one thing that sort of stands out?
Oh, probably getting on to talk to you this morning, Whitey. You
know? I would have thought that's on the podium.
Yeah, that's on the podium. Look, I think it's just the fact that that we've endured for 40 years. But that's in some ways, or largely credit to the game itself, and not just AFL football, but the entire football universe. Like, and we've always, you know, like to talk to people up the bush. We're champion women's football. And then there's all the people that are fans, not only of us, but of football. And maybe that's the thing that gives you some sense of pride, that the objective of giving the fans voice and something to relate to has worked.
Is that the secret to your success, the relatability, the fact that you do genuinely connect with the community when it comes to what footy fans actually feel and think?
Yeah. Look, I've always said, there's one thing we have reflected on along the way. I've always said that there are lots of groups of people like us who either, you know, stand around, well, once upon a time they stood around the tea urn, they now stand around the water cooler at work. And once upon a time they gathered in front bars of hotels, and now they sit around coffee shops. But there's And then they also used to, when you had standing around at the football, you'd stand with a group of people on a Saturday at the footy. And there were people you probably didn't even see during the week, but they were always in the same spot on the Saturday. Yep. And you talked to each other about the footy and crack gags and, you know. And I've said, I've always felt we've been like that. The only difference is we've had access to microphones. And that's probably what people relate to.
Yeah, I reckon you're right. I reckon your reach of not just the AFL and the high level and the VFL even, but it's footy and the whole footy community, and you are able to touch that community, which I think is absolutely one of the secrets for you, Kovey. I'll never forget Torchy's talkback on Grand Final Day 1990 when Digger was in the back of the ambulance. Yeah. Like, at moments like that, that I'm sure everyone out there listening has got a favourite moment of what's been. That's certainly one for me. Are there any moments that stand out for you of what you've been able to pull off on air and you thought that was magic?
Well, that certainly was. You're quite right about that. Now, that's 30 years ago and people still talk about it. And you had no idea that they still would be talked about in 30 years, let alone us being on. That's a good question. I tell you what, we used to do a Sunday night program as well, which we did on the docks down in Hobart, at the end of the Sydney Hobart yacht race. And nice. That stands out because just in this the last week, that at the time in 1993, Victoria were playing Tasmania in a Sheffield Shield match. And Dean Jones had been dropped from the Australian team, was playing for Victoria. And Steve Waugh went into the number three spot, and up in Sydney, he made 100 batting at number three. I think Whitey, an even 100 in a New Year test. Against the West Indies. So Tony Leonard and I went out to Belrive and saw Dino and said, "Hey, come on the radio tonight. We're down at the docks." So we're doing this OB. There's 4,000 people gathered around to watch an OB on radio. Gives you an idea of the lack of entertainment in Hobart. But suddenly this is a big deal. So Dino comes on, which is fantastic of him. He's been dropped out of the Australian team, but he comes down. There's 4,000 there, and Tony opens up with, "Oh, that Steve Waugh seems like a good bloke. How's he going?" You know. "Hey, mate, what, tell us about his 100 today, you know." And Dino was fantastic. You know, cop that played along showed what a fantastic fella he was. So people thought, you know, Dino was all one-way traffic, but he could actually laugh at himself. And that's one thing we pulled off, Harf. We managed to get him to turn up after play. And then also be part of that occasion. I'll never forget that, especially that was highlighted to me just in the last week since Dino's very untimely passing.
Surmising the season of the Melbourne Football Club with their captain, Max Gawn, who's been very generous with his time throughout the season again, and we think that's fantastic, and no doubt played a part in his All-Australian selection last week. Max, good morning. Congratulations.
Morning, Harf. Morning, Whitey. Thank you.
Nice little accolade. It's been a challenging year, I'm sure, on many fronts, but when you get the nod as the All-Australian... Rackman, what goes through your head?
Obviously wasn't necessarily thinking about it on the Thursday directly after the season ending, but a little bit of surprise. I did know I missed some games in there, but I did feel like my form was relatively normal to what I've been playing the last few years when I was playing. So, it will be something I think about towards the end of the year, the end of my career, no doubt, but I'd rather be playing first week of finals this week, and that one's still got me pretty disappointed with how the season's gone.
Which we'll get to very shortly. Where do I find you today, Max? Where are you?
I'm back in Melbourne. I'm back.
What? You came home?
Yeah. I made an interesting decision. I've got a wife back here who was pretty keen on me getting home, so I drove home Sunday and got here late last night.
You drove home?
Right.
Yeah, I had a car up there with a mutual agreement with my old man that he needed back a work ute. So I told him that I'd drive it back, and I did. And it was I regret that decision. Basically, as soon as I got to Coffs Harbour, I regretted that decision.
That is a most unusual end to a season for anyone, I would have thought, Max. Goodness me. So now you've got a quarantine, do you, for a couple of weeks?
No, there's no quarantining down in Melbourne. I think the Victorian borders are open.
We'll take it.
So, Yeah, it was quite phenomenal. I drove from Queensland all the way to Melbourne without getting stopped by anybody with a surfboard on my roof. I mean, it was pretty obvious that I probably should have been stopped, but I didn't.
So how many times did you stop along the way? It's a long way.
Yeah, I stopped in a little town just outside of Sydney called Bow. I don't know how to say it.
Barrel. B-O-W-R-A-L.
That's the one.
Home of Don Bradman.
That's Don Bradman's home, mate. Come on.
Yeah, I actually did see the museum, but when I left at 6 a.m, I thought it might have been closed. but I stopped there and then did the big stint yesterday through Albury and Melbourne.
Oh, good effort. That is a good effort.
That's a great effort.
Well, it's been one of those years where you just had to endure and had to find a way to get through. You've done that again with your trip home. How do you surmise the year for the Ds? Max, we've obviously ridden the wave with you through the season, and there's been some ups and there's been some downs. Getting a chance to sort of sit back and reflect, as I'm sure you did in the car ride, with plenty of time in your hands. What have you made of it?
I think it's a fail. With some positives you can take out of it, just, but in the end, I think we've got a group that's talented enough, and we've shown that in lots of games this year that we can match it with the guys that are playing finals, and you can see that we were almost there until we lost a couple of games in Cairns that, to be fair, we didn't get close, so it wasn't like it was a nail-biting games in Cairns, but they're games that we felt like we probably could have performed better in, and therefore we left it in other people's hands, and Western Bulldogs and St Kilda and Collingwood, those teams were able to win their last couple and made it look quite comfortable. So the positives that come from it are definitely, 1-3 going into the hub, and we came out 8-5 out of the hub. So we were able to perform with our backs against it. Leaving 1-3, you could have ridden your own ticket that we'd made finals almost. So it was a pretty good effort there. And we also had more wins than losses, but the way the season's planned out, and we've come ninth, and no one wants to come ninth. And you can tell the unlucky story that we missed out by the last game of the year, which we did, but we could have been in there a lot earlier, and we should have been in there a lot, locked in a lot earlier.
I remember, Max, how angry you were and others were when you missed out a few years ago now against Collingwood, and it kind of really was a bit of a sort of a spur to get yourself going the following year. Is it a similar sort of emotion this year and what it potentially could be as a springboard for next year, what you're going through at the moment?
It's similar. We've been slightly different. That game in 2017 was the last game of the year that we blew. Where this year it sort of seemed like we were coming from behind the whole time, and then we finally got there in Cairns and we sat it up. And we had a couple of weeks where we had wins and we were able to leave on a good note. So it's slightly different for the sour taste, but certainly the days following the Monday, Tuesday with our meetings and our exit meetings and stuff like that, we certainly felt the disappointment from majority of the people in the hub. And I think that's what's going to spur us on. And we've got a long 3 months now before probably we're going to see anybody, but and then to come back next year. And we will use a little bit of that, but you don't want to keep having to miss the finals to make you make the finals the next year. We want to obviously be a team that makes finals back year on year.
Do you feel confident that next year will be okay? And I know it's still a long way away, but do you feel that based on how you did finish the year, as you touched on, that you are on the right track and that there doesn't necessarily need to be a lot different going into next year, but it's just to perhaps learn on some of the things that went wrong for you this year?
Yeah, I do feel confident, Whitey. You still see probably the favourites in Richmond, and you can probably throw Brisbane and Port in there. Their system is so much better than the names on the paper. Not selling their names on the paper short, but they win games off the back of their system, and that's something that we want to get to. There might have been times this year where we won games purely by individual brilliance. Christian Petracca got us over the line in St Kilda, and you'd rather get win off the games off the back of breaking teams down and just playing your system. And That happened a few times this year, but we'd like them more. And to say we aspire to be Richmond, Brisbane and Port, we probably do because they're the top three, but we want to be our different Melbourne self. But that's the bit that we got to get right. That's we got to train our system over the pre-season, and when it works, it's really good. Like against GWS in the first half and Collingwood throughout the whole game. But when it doesn't work and when we don't turn up and our system's not there, like Port Adelaide and Western Bulldogs in these games, it is really bad. So that's the big one. But it does give me confidence because we do have probably one of the better playing lists I've had since I've been here. So once we get the system stuff right, we'll be a threat, hopefully.
So there's been a lot of conversation the last couple of years about your footy club, Maxi, about who is the real Melbourne footy club. I mean, was 2018 the true indicator, or was 2019, or was this year? And I think the coach said at some stage through the back end of this season that 2018's proven to be a bit of an outlier, which was interesting to hear from him after all that time. Are you more confident going into next season? There's obviously a lot of water to go under the bridge and you're only just getting over this one. But are you more confident about knowing who you are and what is capable now on the back of the last 2 years? 2018 was a long time ago now. So the last 2 years, you've seen a fair few things happen and change and evolve. Do you know you're on the right path now?
I'm not in agreement with Goody as much there. Obviously, when you look at results, it's an outlier, but... Yeah. We 16 and 17, we missed the finals. Well, 17 was ninth, and I think 16 might have been 10th. So we were always in and around that mark. And then 2018, we finished in the bottom four of that top eight, and we had a good finals run. So we were on an upwards trend, and then I believe 19 was the outlier with our performance. And then 20, we've literally gone back to that same result, 10th, 9th, or at the bottom half of the eighth. So we're always sitting around the mark. We want to obviously take that next step, but we've been sitting around the mark for 4 years. So what will make us take that next step, that's what we'll work out over the next 3 months and then the 3 months following that and whenever round one starts. But we've been that team that can win one and then lose one and then finish 9th, 10th, or as we saw in 18, 7th. Or was it 6th? I can't even remember, but... that's where the growth is, I think, half, and that's where we want to show people the real Melbourne more often, and hopefully we can.
That was the best of the Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.